Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, and it's my pleasure today to be joined by Professor Stephen Bittner, who is the author of Whites and Reds, A History of Wine in the Lands of Tsar and Commissar, published by Oxford University Press 2020. Thanks, Stephen, for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So a bit about our guest today. Stephen Bittner is professor of history at Sonoma State University. In addition to this book, Whites and Reds, he is the author of The Many Lives of Khrushchev's Thaw, published in 2008, and the editor of Dmitry Shepilov's memoir, The Kremlin Scholar, published in 2007. In 2019, Bittner was briefly in the news when Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma singled out a fellowship that the National Endowment for the Humanities had awarded to Bittner in support of Whites and Reds as a federal fumble and an example of wasteful government spending. Bittner did not return the fellowship. I try to do that without laughing. So let's leave that in. I think that's a fine introduction, Stephen. Let's talk about the book. I've got a question for you, first of all. So what motivated you to write the book and to start with this topic?
Well, I think that's always the most interesting question for any scholar is, how did we find the topic? And for me, it was, entirely serendipitous. I, was tenured in 2008, I decided that I was going to, try to enjoy life in a way that I hadn't when I was storming to finish my first book. And of course, I live here in Sonoma County in California wine country. And so I became really interested in wine and the technologies of winemaking. And I began to kind of touch base with people in the industry here, picking up advice at the time that I didn't understand would become useful later. And then just by chance, I picked up a copy of The Economist, and I read in The Economist that the Soviet Union in 1985 was the world's fourth largest producer of wine. I subsequently discovered that the Soviet Union may in fact have been the world's third largest producer of wine, trailing only trailing only France and Italy. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. Maybe there's an article in that. And so I in the summer of 2008, I went off to do just a little bit of research in Crimea before the occupation. And even then I came back not knowing whether this was going to be a book or not, but subsequent trips took me to Odessa and to Kiev and Moscow and St. Petersburg and Tbilisi. And before long, I knew that, this would be a book.
Mm-hmm. There's so many stories that you have in your book about about viniculture and the history of wine. So when does it begin in Russia or Rus?
Yeah, so, well, it's there very early. The Russian word for wine is a cognate. It's from the Latin vino. And vino appears in some of the earliest known Russian language texts, such as the Primary Chronicle. And of course, it's not surprising that wine was present in Kiev and Rus. Kiev and Rus was linked via the Dnieper and the Black Sea to Greek civilization at Constantinople. But as East Slavic civilization shifted north and east during the Mongol period, wine disappeared. And it's absent for about 500 years, from the 12th century to the 13th century to the 17th century. And it comes back, as far as we can tell, the first documented presence of Vitis vinifera, the common European wine grape, is in the 1630s. Mm-hmm. And it was brought to Astrakhan on the lower Volga, either by Persian merchants on their way to the Austrian court or Austrian merchants on their way to the Persian court. But even then, it's more of a novelty, and it remains a novelty until the time of Peter the Great, and it's Peter's love of wine, mm-hmm. His desire to turn Russia into a wine producing country that kind of sets the stage for the story that I tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a lot of questions about the Petrine period and the Tsarist period for you in the seven chapters that you outline in the book. I wonder if you might talk about the organization of the book based on your sources and then based on the early choices that you made to arrange it. I think mostly chronologically, right? It seems like mostly like a chronological book.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, the chapters are ordered chronologically. It's not, cut and dry. There's a little bit of overlap. But I always look for stories to tell. I think I'm a historian who likes narrative. And that doesn't mean that I don't try to write interpretive history as well, but I look for interesting stories. So I start out, the chapter that kind of sets the stage, so to speak, is a chapter on the landscapes of winemaking. And I rely heavily on a late 19th century wine writer named Mikhail Balas, who was aware that the concept of terroir existed, but he was convinced that terroir as a characteristic manifest in bottles was not present in Russia. Never mind the fact that he was describing in his writing something that very much resembled a terroir. Mm-hmm. And then I go from there and I look at the Russian response to the phylloxera epidemic in the 1880s and the 1890s. I look at debates about what makes wine authentic. I look at the strange embrace between the remnants of the Tsarist wine industry in the new Soviet state in the 1920s. I look at the impact of Stalinist terror on the wine industry. And then I have a couple of, I think, more fun chapters on the Soviet interaction with the world of Western wine connoisseurs, particularly a pretentious professor from the University of California at Davis who visits the Soviet Union on several occasions. And then I conclude with the Soviet anti-alcoholism campaign in the 1970s and 80s and the impact it had on the wine industry.
Mm-hmm. And so you've already mentioned terroir and Crimea. I wonder if you could give our listeners a kind of geographical understanding of the wine regions of Imperial Russia, Tsarist Russia, or the former Soviet Union. are we talking mainly about Georgia, Bessarabia, Crimea? Where are the regions which you would describe as wine producing?
Yeah. So generally speaking, in the Northern Hemisphere, viniculture is possible right around the 10 degrees Celsius isotherm. So it's that spot on the map where the average temperature is at least 10 degrees Celsius. And then it actually begins to fade as you go farther north, it becomes too cold. And as you go farther south, it becomes too hot. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that the old Tsarist Empire and the Soviet Union had a wine belt along the Black Sea that straddled this 10 degrees Celsius isotherm. And it stretched from present day Moldova in the west. In Tsarist times, it was called Bessarabia. Through southern Ukraine, the Crimean Peninsula, and into the Caucasus. And in fact, both sides of the Caucasus, the north and the south valleys. And these territories, even during Soviet times, these territories accounted for between 70 and 80% of total Soviet wine production.
Wow.
And that's not to say that there weren't grapes grown elsewhere. In the 1960s and 70s, Central Asia emerges as a prominent viticultural region as well. But there's very little difference between where the grapes are coming from in the Tsarist period and where they're coming from in the Soviet period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sometimes, being here in California as well, interviewing you from San Diego to Sonoma, think about these microclimates and places where people, begin to associate wine with place. And certainly this happens if you are talking about Napa and Sonoma. I wonder if you could explain a little bit more from early in your book about terroir, what this is, and then how ethnography and anthropology factor into it to the point where people begin associating food with soil, with place in the Russian geographical imagination.
Yeah, well, the idea of terroir is very old, and I rely here a great deal on the work of Colleen Guy, who has written a very good scholarly and popular history of Champagne, Champagne in the making of French national identity. And Colleen points out that the link between place of provenance and food, there's evidence of this as early as the 13th and the 14th centuries. In France, in the 19th centuries, it becomes medicalized. So for instance, the Franco-Prussian defeat is linked, among other things, to the consumption of unhealthy comestibles, and this leads, among other things, or this serves as a pretext, among other things, for the codification of the French appellation system. So the Russian winemakers are of course aware of this. I mean, the idea of terroir exists in Russia, in the late 19th century. I mean, it's part of that great Russian borrowing of French language, sure, French culture that has been going on since really the time of Catherine, if not earlier. And but at the same time, they're really convinced that Russian consumers are not savvy enough to appreciate terroir, and so there's no incentive for Russian vintners to develop a finely tuned sense of terroir in their wines. Interestingly, in its late 19th and early 20th century manifestation, terroir was a kind of a scientific principle. There was the belief that the soil transmutated itself, or the characteristics of the soil transmutated themselves into the berries, much like an alchemist making gold. And it was precisely at the moment that natural scientists began to question the conceptual foundations of that idea of terroir, that terroir really became an anthropological concept, which is what it is today. We use it to refer to that intersection between human ingenuity and ecology and grape varietal. And so places like Chateau Neuf du Pape in the Rhone Valley, vintners have over many generations perfected the techniques and the varietals to produce wines that are truly singularities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have more questions about some of the techniques of grafting and things like that. And I'm really interested in your sources on the history of science and the science of winemaking. I wonder if I could ask you a question about the monarchy. And by that, I mean, from Peter the Great to the last of the czars, how they understood wine culture within the empire. Do you see this as kind of a grand patronage effort? Do you see it as a coding of European habits and mores in that Peter the Great kind of way, progress in science and modernity? How did you read that in the grand story of your book?
Well, it was all of the above. The royal example was a powerful one. So for instance, the Tokaj varietal, which is a grape we typically associate with Hungary, was very popular at court. In fact, so popular that the autocracy employed a permanent purchasing agent in Hungary to send cases of Tokaj back to St. Petersburg. So without question, this is a story of royal patronage, but it's also a story about, Russia's kind of forcible embrace of Western modes of consumption. We know that Peter preferred wine. I mean, that was his preferred drink. He's so closely associated with wine that the great 19th century critic of the so-called Petrine corruption, Mikhail Pogodin, singles out wine, as evidence.
Culprit.
he says, before Peter, or even the wine on our tables reminds us of Peter, because before Peter, we had no wine. And of course, that's not strictly true, but the gist of it is certainly valid. Wine became, over the course of the 18th century, the consumption of wine was one of the ways that the Russian aristocracy showed itself to be European. Mm-hmm. Indeed, by the end of the 19th century, Russia is one of the largest foreign markets for fine French and German, wines.
Mm-hmm. I'm also curious in how you talk about the southern parts of the empire, and especially in the Caucasus. What's the story of transimperialism, or let's say these intersections of the old Ottoman and maybe even Persian empires with the imperial story of wine? How do you go about understanding not just patronage, but also the people who were involved in the industry, who were developing crown estates, especially in the southern parts of the empire?
Yeah, so this is very interesting. Wine was domesticated in the Russian Empire by virtue of imperialism. So imperialism was the vehicle which made domestic winemaking possible. In all of these territories, from Bessarabia in the west to the Caucasus in the east, they were actually incorporated at a fairly late moment into the Russian Empire. I mean, this was began in 1783 with the annexation of Crimea, and was mostly complete by the end of the Napoleonic Wars. And so these were rather late territorial annexations. And by this moment, of course, the consumption of wine had already been established as a European characteristic. And I think the corollary of that is that the production of wine was also a European characteristic. Mm-hmm. And this raises really interesting questions about the, you know, the nature of the interaction between, you know, the Russians on the one hand and the Moldovans, the Crimeans, the Georgians on the other. You know, in some sense, these people who were brought into the empire were more European than the Russians themselves, you know, insofar as they had a culture and economy of winemaking that was, you know, in some cases, many millennia old. Mm-hmm. I mean, Georgia claims to be, you know, the place where humans first mastered the grape. Mm-hmm. This would have been, you know, six millennia before the Common Era. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and we can contrast this with Russia, which had almost no indigenous viticultural expertise. And so in some sense, I think the story of viticulture during the 18th and 19th centuries, it turns on its head the, you know, the imperial hierarchies. Mm-hmm. And then I can also add to it that we can think of wine as a byproduct of imperialism. You know, the consumption of wine is a byproduct of imperialism in the ways that many Russians experienced imperialism in the big cities of the north was through the consumption of wine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so often I think the scholarship on Tsarist and Soviet imperialism has focused on the ways the Tsarist and Soviet states tried to modernize and regulate and collate and
count.
make sense of the imperial borderlands.
But
this kind of, I think wine suggests we should look the other way as well and think about the way the borderlands changed the core.
Yeah, I'm really interested in that story that you tell, Stephen, in Georgia, and I'm thinking about Dara Goldstein's work. On the one hand, you have this top-down story, I guess I would call it, of administrators who are Russian serving the czars, and they're coming in, and it's their job, like Mikhail Vorontsov, with the development of the Crimean wine industry, then to go to other regions. And yet, you know, you have locals who are also agents and actors in the story. I wonder if you could introduce them. I'm thinking about the peasant vintners and, you know, how they might have been involved one way or another in the business or the industry of wine production. How do you get at that story?
Well, let me respond by focusing on two different areas. So I'll start with Georgia. You know, in the first emissaries of Tsarist power to arrive in Georgia were astounded at the depth of viniculture in the local economy. And, you know, Christian von Steven, the Finnish botanist, when he arrived in Kahetia in the early 1800s, he wrote that the Kahetian plain was an unbroken swath of vineyards. And that's almost certainly embellishment. But still, it was quite startling to him. But nonetheless, there's at the same time kind of conviction among many of these Russian administrators that Georgian peasants did not fully comprehend the gravity of their endeavor. You know, for Georgian peasants, wine was an unpretentious staple of their daily diet. It was not, you know, a civilizational marker, which is how the Russians understood it. And so the Georgian wine industry, you know, tended to be very insular. Until the late 19th century, there's actually very little Georgian wine that's making it out of Georgia.
That was surprising to me. That was very surprising.
And this is principally because the biggest market for Georgian wine are Georgians themselves.
Right.
And most Georgian wine production was occurring at home, in the house. You know, in Kahéty, virtually every house would have had a kevri in the backyard or in the barn, mm-hmm. Where wine was fermented. And this really changes, the insularity begins to change with the arrival of German colonists. I think there's 480 families from Württemberg who arrive in the early 1800s and divide themselves into several viticultural communities. And then especially the crown estates. In a crown, this requires a little bit of explanation. A crown estate is an estate that is owned directly by the royal family and whose proceeds goes directly to the upkeep of the royal family. And there was a crown estate in Kahéty, and it actually employed, at the end of the 19th century, it employed an Italian vintner. And by the end of the 19th century, some of these Georgian wines were beginning to appear in, marketplaces in London and Paris. So there is evidence of some, foreign demand for wine from exotic Kahéty. But, Georgia is kind of the case of insularity. I think Crimea, even before annexation, was much more closely linked with international markets. Crimea was multi-ethnic and multi-confessional. I mean, there were Karaites, there were Greeks, there were Genoans, there were Tatar growers. And some of this wine made its way north, to the marketplaces in Russia. But some of it was also shipped across the Black Sea. So the Russians, they encountered, a fairly well-developed wine economy, although that didn't mean that the Russians didn't disparage the quality of wine that the Crimeans made. And this was, again, a way that those imperial hierarchies that had been turned on their head by the ubiquity of winemaking in the South, how they could be then righted. So, the Russians brought with them the expertise, the scientific expertise to make fine wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm very interested in the shifts that go on in your book, I would say, from maybe a romantic understanding of sort of colonial development in the South and in the Caucasus, then to this more positivistic and ultimately almost like Darwinian struggle for existence mentality about grapes. And I guess, my next question for you would be about the wine blight and what it meant for Russia. I guess, people who are familiar with wine and food studies will know about the phylloxera epidemic in France and all the effects that it had on the wine industry there. How did the Russian imperial societies, like the Imperial Society for Agriculture and others, who are involved as academics in the empire, try to resolve this? Because I would guess it was pretty catastrophic.
It was catastrophic for a wealthy country like France. You can imagine what it did to a comparatively poor country like Russia. So phylloxera comes ashore in the South sometime in the 1870s. It's first documented at an estate outside of Suhumi in present-day Abkhazia, Georgia. And then it spreads particularly through the Dniester River Valley in Moldova. And, by the end of the epidemic, by the end of the blight, something like 1,800 square kilometers of vineyards had perished in Moldova. And some of these vineyards actually perished twice. That is, yeah. They perished once, they were replanted, and then they perished again. And the campaign against phylloxera was waged principally by an organization called the Imperial Society for Agriculture in Southern Russia. This was headquartered in Odessa. It had a building in the municipal garden right off Deribasovskaya Street. And the key figure here was a really very important natural scientist named Alexander Kovalevsky. Kovalevsky had made a name for himself by studying fossils, vertebrate and invertebrate fossils, and his work was so significant that Darwin cited it in the Descent of Man. And Kovalevsky considered himself to be a Darwinist. And so when he looked at phylloxera, he saw a struggle for existence occurring between the European vine, Vitis vinifera, the vine that was endangered, and the American vine. And the American vine was Vitis riparia, that's the riverbank vine, or Vitis labrusca, the fox vine. And these were these vines were very much coveted by Victorian era gardeners, which was actually the vehicle which brought the phylloxera aphid to Europe, probably in the 1840s or 1850s. So the American vines had evolved alongside the phylloxera aphid, and they had some degree of resistance to phylloxera. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so Kovalevsky, he was a scientific positivist, and he was active kind of right at the advent of chemical agriculture. So he was convinced from the start that the solution to phylloxera lay in some sort of pesticide. Mm-hmm. And what they eventually arrived at was using carbon disulfide. And this carbon disulfide would be injected into the soil in infected vineyards. And it may have been the case that carbon disulfide actually had a palliative effect. So vines that were sick, their eventual death was prolonged by the use of carbon disulfide. But there's actually very little evidence that carbon disulfide could permanently cure a vine of infection. Mm-hmm.
There is, just to be clear, there is no cure for this, right? I mean, there are some regions like in Chile that are maybe not affected, or Greece, but there's still no clear cure for it, right?
Yeah. The solution, as it turned out, was timeless. It was ancient. The solution to phylloxera was vinicultural grafting. So you take the top part of the European grape, Vitis vinifera, and you graft it to the root stock of the American grape, Vitis riparia or Vitis labrusca. Because aphid principally attacks the roots, and because the American roots were immune, this was a way to protect vineyards. It's obviously also exceedingly expensive. Mm-hmm. It basically meant that vineyards had to be uprooted and replanted. But it also means, when you drive through wine country in California or in Bordeaux or in upstate New York and you see a vineyard, you are in fact seeing two species of plants that have been grafted together. And that's the only way to protect the vines from phylloxera. Mm-hmm. But Kovalevsky was hesitant to embrace grafting, in part because he thought that it was the ancient cure, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Cato writes about grafting.
Right. That's a good point.
So it definitely, it challenged his scientific positivism.
Yeah.
But he also didn't want to embrace grafting because he thought it meant taking sides in this struggle for existence between the American vines and the European vines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting throughout your book, Stephen, how many things are coded as Western or European or modern or traditional or advanced. And I guess, you know, I don't want to let you go without asking big questions about the revolutionary divide and the Soviet period. So, you know, the revolution must have been pretty devastating, I guess, to the aristocratic history of wine culture and even the sort of middle class consumption, wine habits. How did the Soviets then begin to rework this old kind of monopoly or system of profit around the industry?
Yeah, well, I mean, let me put this in the context of viticultural disasters. So, you know, I think when you take the entire 19th and 20th centuries in toto, I think we can say that Russia and the Soviet Union experienced four viticultural disasters. There was phylloxera, a force majeure. There was the First World War and Revolution. There was the German and Romanian occupation of the wine belt during the Second World War. And then there was Gorbachev's anti-alcoholism campaigns. So all of these were kind of human caused or human exacerbated. And of these four disasters, I think clearly the period around the First World War and the revolution was most destructive.
That's interesting.
That's in large part because, you know, Russia actually loses many of its viticultural possessions. So, for instance, Moldova, Bessarabia, is annexed by the Kingdom of Romania. And it doesn't return to the Soviet fold until the famous Hitler-Stalin Pact. Odessa is briefly occupied by French forces. Transcaucasia falls under the control of the British, and so Russia, you know, at least temporarily, actually loses control of many of its viticultural territories. But you know, I think if we look at the, you know, the revolutionary caesura and what happens to wine across the caesura, you know, I think we would expect that the wine industry would not fare well under the Soviets.
Right.
I mean, the Tsarist wine industry was dominated by aristocrats and wealthy foreign investors. So, for instance, the Roederer family from Champagne-Ardennes had a sparkling wine factory in Odessa. But as it turned out, the cultural meanings of wine actually changed very little across the revolutionary caesura. In fact, many of the people who remained behind, these Tsarist holdovers, they looked optimistically on this kind of newly empowered, newly activist Soviet state, because they thought that wine was too important to leave to the chaos of the free market. So wine had to be regulated. And they're greatly disappointed in 1921 when Lenin decrees the NEP retreat and the free market returns to the commercial sector. And, you know, this is these holdovers from the Tsarist wine industry, they certainly weren't communists, but this just seemed to them to be a betrayal of everything they had hoped for from the new Soviet state. And obviously, they get their wish in the 1930s with Stalin. In 1936, Stalin famously declares that champagne is part of the good life of socialism.
Right.
And then the Soviet state really takes a very activist role in promoting the development of the domestic wine industry. But at the same time, Stalinism would spell the destruction of many of these holdovers from the Tsarist period.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you talk a little bit about the alcohol industry in general in the Stalin period and beyond to the post-Stalin era? If we're juxtaposing wine next to champagne, next to vodka, what is the fate, I guess, both culturally and economically of the wine industry as you know, finally we get to Gorbachev and the fourth catastrophe, as you mentioned, but there are so many jokes from the 60s and in film, and your book is full of these great sort of humoristic and satiristic sketches. What happens to the alcohol industry during this period? And then, you know, what's the popular perception of both wine and champagne and adulterated and unadulterated wines?
Well, let me jump forward all the way to the final Soviet decades. So, you know, the first anti-alcoholism initiatives are approved by the Soviet Central Committee in 1972. And, you know, this is the Brezhnev period. And at this moment, there's a clear distinction drawn between vodka, which is undeniably destructive to health and welfare and economic performance. And so vodka on one hand, and then beer and wine on the other. In fact, the wine industry, or officials in the wine industry, looked at this legislation in 1972, and for the most part, they thought it would be good for them, mm-hmm. because finally the Soviet state was going to try to wean consumers from vodka,
right.
and to promote wine as a more healthy alternative to vodka. And let me say that there's actually not much evidence that wine is a cure for alcoholism.
I had that question too.
The evidence that they always cited was purely anecdotal or coincidental. It was, they would look at countries like Spain, France, and Italy where wine was the principal alcoholic beverage, but alcoholism was far less common than in the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So that's what they hoped. I mean, they really hoped that this would lead to this, you know, revitalization.
Healthy period, healthy population.
But what happens is actually very different. What happens is that the Soviet wine industry, for a whole variety of reasons, but principally among them is consumer demand, produces something that's called barmatuka. And barmatuka is a slang word that comes from the Russian word to mumble. And, mm-hmm. and so barmatuka literally is the wine that makes you mumble. And so it is wine that is sweetened typically with beet sugar and strengthened with grain alcohol to about 19% alcohol by volume. So, mm-hmm. So everybody's clear, that's about half strength vodka, right? Vodka is 80 proof, 40% alcohol. In the 1970s and the early 1980s, barmatuka comprised somewhere around 90% of total Soviet wine production. Mm-hmm. And it was sold as port wine or vermouth, or aroma of the steppe, or maritime, or sometimes just it was just called strong wine, krepkoe vino, and it was immensely popular among Soviet consumers because it really spoke to the Soviet palate for strong and sweet. And this is actually, you know, there's great continuity in taste. And the Soviet palate is, for the most part, also the late Tsarist palate. The preference was for strong wine and sweet wine. And as a result of this, in 1985, when Mikhail Gorbachev comes to power and there's another big anti-alcoholism initiative, it becomes really more or less impossible to differentiate between wine and vodka anymore, because the vast majority of wine is barmatuka. It's half-strength vodka. No one is, in their right mind would claim that barmatuka is any more healthy than vodka. The result is that, the vineyards and wine industry that was exempted in 1972 is not exempted in 1985. The Soviet wine industry goes into a very sharp decline right at the end of the Soviet period.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you talk about this connoisseurship of wine, and you mentioned the professor from the University of California, Davis, who's the author of all these books and articles. So what does this mean, I guess, in your book for the coding of wine consumption? I'm thinking about, you know, travels to wine country here in California and elsewhere. How are you reading this ultimately in the end, if you're comparing the production of Russian and Soviet wine with more famous examples like Bordeaux, regions, you know, villages outside of Avignon? What does this mean ultimately for the history and legacy of Soviet wine? Is it still coded culturally in a particular way through Russian literature and film and elsewhere?
You know, it. You know, I think your question speaks to you know, one of the you know, the great joys of writing about wine, about Russian and Soviet wine from the vantage point of California. And, you know, California was one of the great viticultural success stories of the 20th century. And it really reordered hierarchies in the world of wine, beginning in the 1970s and that famous Judgment of Paris. And, you know, so much of the optimism, you know, this kind of upstart, we're going to show those old world wine producers a thing or two. You also see that in Tsarist Russia and in the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, the acme of Tsarist winemaking came in 1900. This was the year of the Universal Exposition in Paris. And there was a wine tasting in Bordeaux that corresponded with the exposition. And the best in show honors. So that is the best wine that was competitively tasted was a sparkling wine from Novi Svet, which at the time was not a crown estate, but would become a crown estate. And the vintner at Novi Svet was a man named Lev Golitsyn. And of course, my Russianist colleagues who are listening to this podcast will recognize the Golitsyn name as one of the oldest.
Right. Of the Golitsyns.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, Golitsyn always considered himself to be, you know, a real Russian patriot. But he said that the title that mattered most to him was Russian vintner. Like that was the identity that he assumed. And so there was this moment, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century where it appeared that Russia was going to become what California and Australia and Chile and Argentina would become over the course of the 20th century. But of course, that potential was mostly squandered. You know, again, in the 1960s and the 1970s, Soviet vintners begin to submit their bottles for international review, principally in the socialist world, but sometimes on rare occasions beyond the ideological frontier, you know, and they, the results are modest. Like they win, you know, if you remember a label for Soviet champagne, it was always adorned with medals from international tasting competitions in Ljubljana, mm-hmm. In Budapest, in Bratislava, and, you know, the sort of capital cities of the socialist world. But my vintner goes, my vintner from UC Davis, Maynard Amarin, visits Russia on three occasions in the 1960s and the early 1970s. And, you know, Amarin was such a beautiful find for me because I think we have this expectation that as Russianists, all our sources are in Russia. But in fact, I found, you know, these really wonderful travel journals that were just, you know, 40 miles from where I live. Mm-hmm. And Amarin took really copious tasting notes. And for the most part, the wine he tasted in the Soviet Union was I don't know what the adjective is here, abhorrent to him, repulsive.
Too sweet.
But interestingly, he did not think the wine was flawed for mystical reasons. Like he didn't ever put much stock in, you know, right. terroir or anything like that. He thought that just the winemakers were making mistakes. And they, interestingly, the socialist economy lacked the feedback mechanisms that made fine wine routine rather than a matter of chance. You know, as a historian, I have to say taste is one of the hardest things to write about because we're really dependent upon the people we write about also describing taste. When I found these travel journals and special collections over at UC Davis, I knew right away, I mean, within about 5 minutes of reading, I knew that I had something that was really precious because he was writing about taste, you know, he was scoring bottles and you know, he had this sort of very colorful language to describe most of the bottles that were flawed in his view and why they were flawed.
I was thinking about that too, Stephen, you know, what wine your book should be paired with when it's consumed. So I guess, you know, the final question I have for you is if you could maybe recommend up to the present, because you cover everything really, including Russian Georgian politics and, you know, the embargo on Georgian wines. What sort of books are you interested in or writings among people in this field?
Well, how about I recommend both wine and books?
Yeah, let's do that. You okay, can be our sommelier.
Well, first, you know, a word of warning, it's not easy to find wine from the former Soviet Union in the United States. Although I think with a little bit of effort, it's possible. So I would recommend two wines. Any bottle from Pheasant's Tears, which is a company in Signagi in eastern Georgia. And Pheasant's Tears actually makes wine in the traditional Georgian way. So the grapes are aged not in oak barrels, but in kevri, in amphorae that are lined with beeswax and buried in the ground. And then, so that's the first wine I would recommend. The second would be any bottle of Soviet champagne. And I know they're obtainable in the States because I just drank a bottle a couple days ago. And that was the most popular wine within the Soviet Union, the most popular label within the Soviet Union.
Books. What books?
And then for books, I would recommend Colleen Guy's Making Champagne French, which is kind of the classic in the world of historical literature about wine. And then a book which is not yet published, but will very soon be published, is Jennifer Regan Lefebvre's Imperial Wine, which is a story about how the British Empire made the world of winemaking in the Antipodes in Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. And that book should be out very shortly.
Excellent. And finally, this truly is my last question. I want to know, and our listeners here on New Books Network want to know, what you're working on now. What's next for you?
So I have two very different projects in the hopper. And they're very different from wine. I'm interested in the smaller project is something on the Soviet presence in Antarctica, where the Soviets maintained a research base at the magnetic South Pole. The Americans were at the geographic South Pole. And I'm not sure if that's going to be a book or a series of articles, but that's one thing I'm working on this summer. And then the other is I have a bigger project going on the places where refugees from Bolshevism encountered refugees from Nazism. And I'm really interested in the spatial component here, the places. And one of those places is here in California. It was in Los Angeles, which where the Hollywood studio system provided employment for many people who were fleeing the great isms of the 20th century. I anticipate this will be a sort of prosopographical project. So I'm interested in the interrelations between these two groups of refugees.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, you know, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast for New Books Network and for New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies and New Books History and New Books Food. I want to congratulate you on your book. The book is called Whites and Reds, A History of Wine in the Lands of Tsar and Commissar, just out now with Oxford University Press. My guest here, Stephen Bittner, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Stephen.
And I'm your host, Stephen Siegel. Until next time here on the New Books Network.